You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias.
Hello, normal people, and welcome to this brand new episode of the podcast. Now, you may know that on our website, we have an Ask Pete page where you can submit your questions, and that seemed like a really good idea at the time. The thing is that there are a lot of questions that I can't keep up, and I'm sort of overwhelmed. So what we do is periodically post some answers to our YouTube channel and for our patrons over at Patreon, where you too can watch those videos for as little as $1 a month. And other times, like this time, we try to hit a few at once on a podcast. So here's what I did. I went through the list of like 200 questions and took a few of them that have a common theme. These are questions related directly to things I've said on other podcasts or in writing somewhere like on blogs and some books. And that's a theme that unites these questions. So I'll keep my responses, you know, relatively brief because I want to get through 7 questions if I can, and we'll see how things go.
Persil sorgt schon seit 1907 für tiefenreine Wäsche, auch bei den Johnsons, oder Anna?
Das stimmt. Sogar meine Oma hat schon mit Persil gewaschen.
Und als Dankeschön für über 100 Jahre Vertrauen gibt's jetzt bis zu 15 Euro Rabatt auf unser Bestes.
Das mit der roten Schleife.
Genau, made in Germany. Mehr Infos auf unserbestes.persil.de.
Wenn es tiefenrein ist, ist es Persil.
Wahnsinn, wie schnell das Jahr wieder vorbeigezogen ist. Fast wie die Elektrofahrzeuge und Plug-in-Hybride von Opel. Und noch was kommt angebraust. Bis zu 5.000 Euro mit der geplanten gesetzlichen Förderprämie für E-Mobilität 2026. So geht klimafreundlicheres Fahren. Lass dich unverbindlich und persönlich beraten. Alle Infos auf opel.de. Die Höhe und Verfügbarkeit der staatlichen Förderungen hängen von den jeweils gültigen Richtlinien ab. Ob und wie sie die Voraussetzungen erfüllen, wird im Einzelfall geprüft.
Okay, so here's the first question.
The character Job says, "The Lord gave and the Lord hath taken away." I understand it to be saying that whatever happens, whether we perceive it as good or bad, happens because God caused it. But the story of Job says Satan caused Job's suffering. God merely permitted it. People frequently quote Job's statement in the context of the death of a loved one. What do you believe about this?
All right, this question relates to my last solo podcast on Job, and the question picks up on a real tension in Job. And the passage referred to is Job 1:21, which concludes with another famous line, "The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Now, it really is true that Job here is saying that whatever happens, good or bad, it's God's doing, and we need to accept both as God's will. And yet, readers of Job know that the issue is a bit more complicated. God didn't really do anything, but allowed Satan to do what he saw fit. And actually, I'm going to say Satan instead of Satan. And if you'll allow me just a quick side note, some of you may remember from my podcast that the Hebrew word Satan isn't the name of the king of the underworld. In fact, the Hebrew is not a name at all, but a title, meaning something like the accuser or the adversary. And in Job, this adversary is not an angel, but a divine being who, and that's weird, I know, but a divine being who, you know, along with other divine beings, has a seat at a sort of like a heavenly board meeting with Israel's God as CEO. That's the scene we have here in Job. And this kind of a meeting is usually referred to as a heavenly council or a divine council. Okay, side note over. So as the story goes, God is bragging to Satan, Satan, about how pious Job is. And Satan accuses God, right, the accuser, he accuses God of protecting Job and making his life flush so God can get the praise. You know, Satan says, in effect, you know, put a little pressure on him and Job will fold faster than Superman on laundry day. Now, what's at stake in all of this is God's own reputation. If Job fails the test, God will look bad for bragging about Job. So right there, this bet complicates the whole all things good and evil come from God, so praise him regardless idea. Also, as we keep reading in Job, we see that the pious answer Job gives at first in 1:21 eventually gives way to a sustained complaint that he's suffering for some unknown reason and God needs to let him in on why he's suffering when he didn't do anything to deserve it. So here's another wrinkle. That verse, Job 1:21, accept both good and evil as God's will. That verse is itself in tension with how the book proceeds. Job doesn't maintain his 1:21 outlook. In fact, he already abandons it in chapter 3. And I think respecting that tension between what he says in one place and what he says in other places, that's a very important thing for grasping the theology of the book of Job. Now, I admit that Job 1:21 is a very tempting passage to cite when we face suffering, either our own or someone else's. It seems like a neat and clear sort of one-size-fits-all answer to any bad thing that happens. This is God's mysterious will. God gives, God takes away, deal with it. And this use of Job 1:21 is certainly part of the Christian tradition. It's a way of submitting to the mystery of God. And truly, I get that, and I want to respect that mystery. But if I may be so bold, I think that this way of looking at 1:21 is a misunderstanding of this passage and how it works in the overall picture of Job. This is not a standalone verse that says something absolute about what God is like. It's the confession of a biblical character, Job, in chapter 1, who's being tested for only the first time in his flesh life. And his statement of faith is born out of an untested piety. In other words, he gives the right answer, like we sometimes do in church. The deeper and more authentic, more honest struggles of the suffering Job, well, that's going to occupy the rest of the book. And if my understanding of the end of the book is right, and that's another podcast plug, by the way, but if my understanding of the end of the book is right, Job never gives in. He maintains his innocence and holds his ground to the end. And in the last chapter, God vindicates Job. Well, anyway, it's a great question, and to answer it well really forces us to dig into the big picture of Job, which is not a quick fix. It's always harder to see the big picture than it is to find a verse and use it. Gee, I wish there were a podcast on this, preferably under an hour, that was released not too long ago. All right, enough plugging. On to the next question.
I'm curious why Pete thinks it is appropriate to use a biological concept, evolution, for literary analysis of the Pentateuch. Where else in literary studies has evolution played such a role? Interestingly, the scholars who followed Wellhausen's theory regarding the Pentateuch have splintered in many directions. This fact seems to indicate the theory is based on mere speculation rooted in personal bias.
This question concerns my next to last podcast, which was on the literary analysis of the Pentateuch. And all kidding aside, it might not be a bad idea to listen to that episode if this question and if my answer interests you. So to sum up the issue from the podcast, the question scholars have been asking for about 300 years is why the Pentateuch looks so uneven and so contradictory in places. And in the 18th century, German scholars came up with an idea that eventually came to be called the documentary hypothesis, which many people have heard of, even, you know, if you haven't gone to seminary or something. And anyway, this was popularized by the German scholar Julius Wellhausen in the 19th century, which is the person mentioned in the question. Now, Wellhausen's basic point, once we clear away some of the clutter, and which is still the overwhelmingly dominant view today, is that the Pentateuch was not written at one time by one person, say by Moses in the mid-second century BCE. Rather, the Pentateuch grew over time. Written traditions began to emerge once the monarchy was established, so like 10th century BCE. More texts were written by Israelites and then collected, edited together, and added to over several centuries until sometime after the 5th century, roughly. And that process eventually came to an end with the Pentateuch, more or less as we know it today. Now, here's the point. I refer to this process, this development, as an evolution. And the questioner is wondering why I would use a biological concept to describe a literary phenomenon. But this is not a big deal, really. You know, to say that the Pentateuch evolved is simply an analogy, and I think a good one. The process of editing over time really is something like a series of adaptations to changing times and situations. As time passed, these traditions grew to fit changing circumstances. And again, forgive me, but the podcast might help flesh that out because it's sort of an intricate issue. It gets a little bit tricky, and I spend more time there working through the issue with a little more patience. The fact that evolution is a biological concept, which, side issue, isn't actually quite true. It's also a cosmological and geological concept, but I know what the questioner's after. But the fact that evolution is from another field, let's say, doesn't mean it shouldn't be used when describing the Bible. In fact, that's how analogies work. You use a concept from a different thing to describe something else. You know, the movement of the planets is like a finely tuned watch. I wonder, though, if the questioner isn't really bothered by my simply using an analogy. Had I said something like the flowering of the Pentateuch, I don't know if the question would have been submitted at all. I sense the issue here is that the questioner does not like evolution specifically to be tied to the Bible. And I understand that. I vehemently disagree, but I understand. But perhaps it would have been better had she said, I think evolution is untrue and I don't like tying it to the Bible. See, I could accept that, but claiming that evolution can't be used as an analogy because it is from the field of biology, well, it seems to miss what analogies do, which again is to describe something less familiar by something more familiar. And not to dig too deep into this, but in addition to the discomfort with evolution, the questioner also makes the rather common mistake of thinking that scholarly movement beyond Wellhausen is an indictment on his theory. As the questioner puts it, the theory has splintered, quote, splintered in many directions, end quote, and is therefore, quote, mere speculation rooted in personal bias. But the theory hasn't gone into self-destruct mode. The original 19th century theory has, forgive me, evolved, mutated into various sub-theories. And this is not evidence that the whole theory is, quote, mere speculation rooted in personal bias. It just means that scholarship is happening. Scholarship on the Pentateuch has definitely changed since Wellhausen's day, just as science has changed since Darwin's day in the 19th century. The parallel is really interesting to me. See, both Wellhausen and Darwin, at roughly the same time, proposed a theory of origins, the origin of the Pentateuch and the origin of humanity. And in both cases, scholarship has moved on while also acknowledging the debt to the 19th century. You see, no scholar today is a devoted follower of Wellhausen. Just as no evolutionary biologist today is a devoted follower of Darwin. Scholarship changes over time, but that doesn't mean the theories have splintered or are mired in personal bias. It's just how scholarship works. All right, next question.
Pete frequently says something like, most scholars agree. Who are these agreeing scholars? I don't find them in the seminary professors that I've talked to about Pete's view of the ancient, ambiguous, diverse Bible.
All right, well, I want to be honest here. I hesitated a bit whether to include this question for fear it might be misunderstood as dismissive. But this question has come up in some form with respect to podcasts and my writing, so I think there's value in addressing it. Now, it would help me to have an example or two of where I am claiming broad academic agreement on an issue where there isn't any that we don't have. So just let me answer this generally, and I hope that's going to be helpful. Remember, this is the Bible for normal people where we are trying to bring the best of biblical scholarship to non-specialists. Sometimes nuances and subtleties do get lost in that exchange. But when I say things like most scholars agree or something like that, and I mean it, I'm not pulling things out of thin air. The topics we address on this podcast and that I write about in my books, they don't raise an eyebrow, really, among biblical scholars. In fact, they're more or less right down the middle. And that's true even if there are scholarly disagreements about some things. Now, this is where I'm hesitating, and I hope this will be accepted in the best possible light. It's possible, and I suspect this is the case, that the questioner may not be familiar with how widely or generally held the views I express are, which is absolutely fine. I'm a little more curious that his seminary professors seem unfamiliar with these things. This suggests to me that this question is arising out of a conservative space, where the kinds of conversations we are trying to have here may not be the kinds of conversations valued elsewhere. That too is fine, but those values do not constitute a legitimate criticism of what scholars do elsewhere, and I hope that makes some sense. When I say things like most or a good many or a strong consensus of scholars agree on X, Y, or Z, I am actually signaling for people in the know that yes, virtually every issue in biblical studies has a flurry of debate surrounding it. In other words, I can't see myself ever saying every single biblical scholar alive today or something like that, because sooner or later someone will push and prod a majority view, which is what scholarship is supposed to do. But in this context of connecting people with biblical scholarship, if there is a view that is so widespread as to not be seriously debated, I have no hesitation saying something like, with extremely rare exception, this is the majority view. And you know, one example of this is from the previous question. The Pentateuch is a first millennium product of a long process and not a second millennium creation by one author writing at one time. Now, this is important, but also another place where I'm hesitating. If the scholars who doubt that consensus are primarily those with deeply conservative, dogmatic, ecclesiastical commitments, like some form of literalism or inerrancy, for example. And I'm being honest, I don't feel the need to include them in my sample size. In fact, if I did and said, some scholars think the Pentateuch is a first millennium product, I would actually be misleading people into thinking that the debate over this particular issue is widespread. Views that oppose a strong academic consensus and that are fueled by an apologetic stance to defend a particular doctrine are not part of the scholarly conversation as far as I'm concerned. And I'm aware that some will accuse me of bias or closed-mindedness, and that's fine too. I would simply respond that rejecting an academic scholarly conclusion for dogmatic or ecclesiastical reasons is a much more serious form of bias and closed-mindedness.
Jeder meckert über den ÖPNV. Aber was steckt wirklich dahinter? Mit dem Podcast Ticket to Anywhere blickst du hinter die Kulissen des Nahverkehrs. Schauspieler Maximilian Mund reist zu seiner Oma, trifft spannende Menschen wie Malte Zierden oder Linda Zervakis und erklärt alles zu Bus und Bahn und wie sie besser werden können. Erlebe ein außergewöhnliches Audioerlebnis rund um unsere alltägliche Mobilität. Jetzt reinhören auf Spotify oder unter zukunftnahverkehr.de/podcast.
Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
Okay, Pete. Any happy questions in there? Well, not really happy, but some of these are really interesting. And here's another one of them.
Is there any evidence that the events recorded in Exodus line up chronologically with the Amarna period in Egypt? Among other things, I'm thinking about the monotheism of Akhenaten.
Okay, so first of all, what is the Amarna period? Actually, what is Amarna? Well, it's a town in Egypt. And in 1887, some clay tablets were discovered there. And these tablets date to the time of Pharaoh Akhenaten, who reigned in the middle of the 14th century BCE. Keep that date in your head, 14th century, 1300s. These clay tablets were actually written by Canaanites, the residents of the land of Canaan up there, and they were written by Canaanites to Akhenaten in the Akkadian language, which is the language of international diplomacy at the time. And these letters were a very big deal because they give us a glimpse of life in Canaan in the, I'll say it again, 14th century. In this case, it's a record of Canaanites rebelling against Egyptian rule of that region, I'm going to say that again. Egyptian rule of Canaan in the 14th century. Okay, who cares? Well, the questioner does, but I want you to care too. See, the 14th century is the time, a little math coming here, folks, but that's the time when the Israelites would have been settled in Canaan according to the literal timeline given in the Bible. What is that timeline? Well, Solomon's temple was built, according to the Book of Kings, quote, in the 480th year after the Israelites came out of Egypt. Solomon's temple dates to the middle of the 10th century BCE, and 480 years back from that brings us to the 15th century. Specifically, the date most often landed on, for a number of reasons, is 1446 BCE as the date for the Exodus. So, middle of the 15th century, the date of the Exodus. All right, let's get on with this. See, the problem is that this date of 1446 runs into some serious chronological problems because it would place Israel's existence in Canaan in the 15th century, or at least in the early 14th century. That means, this is one of the punchlines, folks, that means that Israelites would presumably have been a fixture in Canaan by the time of the Amarna letters about 100 years later. The problem is that the Canaan that the Amarna letters depict don't include Israelites. Now, there is a later Egyptian monument from around 1207 BCE, very late 13th century, that does mention Israel by name, which is very cool, but no Israelites in Canaan in the 14th century. According to the Amarna letters, Canaan is inhabited by Canaanites living in city-states like Shechem, Gezer, Ashkelon, and Jerusalem, each with their own king. And also, just think about this. The Book of Judges, which would be taking place during the Amarna period, according to that literal timeline, but the Book of Judges doesn't mention Egyptian presence in the land. Their problem in Judges is largely the Philistines, not the Egyptians. Add to that the archaeological support for the destruction of some of the towns and cities mentioned in the conquest stories of the Old Testament, like the Book of Joshua. Well, that archaeological evidence comes from the 12th century and later, which is also the time when we see strong evidence, archaeological evidence, for an influx of settlements in the hill country of Israel, which is also the picture that the Bible presents. Now, just apart from the Amarna letters entirely, the little evidence we have for the conquest and the Exodus, that evidence strongly suggests that the 15th century is just way too early for the Exodus and way too early for the beginning of the conquest of the land of Canaan. The Amarna letters seem to indicate that there is no Israelite presence in Canaan in the 14th century. The biblical timeline doesn't work. And a later period has to be sought for the Exodus and the conquest of Canaan, which is what some of the evidence I just mentioned talks about, like the influx of hill country settlements and some destruction of some towns. It's a big issue. It's a lot to chew on. And, you know, you can see why it's not easy to discuss the history of the Exodus and conquest during fellowship hour after the service. Now, as for the pharaoh Akhenaten, we got to get to him. He is often referred to as the first monotheist for declaring that the god Aten, which is where he gets his name from, Akhenaten, but he declared that this god Aten, the sun disk, was the only god. Now, what drove this pharaoh to make such a unique claim is debated, but it probably isn't some deep spiritual insight that there is, in fact, only one god, even though everyone else believed in many gods. There were probably economic and political factors involved and other things as well. And, you know, don't forget the idea of only one god, that died with him, that didn't catch on.
Stay tuned for more Bible for Normal People.
Hi, this is Peter Watts from Seattle, Washington. As a Patreon supporter, one of the things I really enjoy about this community is that I have the freedom to ask any question I have about the Bible. It also gives me and others the space to explore Bible topics from new angles and new perspectives. I enjoy the honesty of Pete and Jared as they open up and talk about their own questions and personal tensions with the Bible, and engage with the questions of Patreon supporters. When you become a Patreon member, you have access to all their latest video content and to the wider Bible for Normal People community. If this community sounds like something you could benefit from, then sign up to be a Patreon supporter for as little as $1 a month. Just go to patreon.com/thebibleforNormalPeople or visit us on iTunes. At this time, I want to thank our producers, Martin Breithaupt, Joel Herring, Joel Thompson, Stephen Goldstone, Danita Fenn, Joe Johnson, Aaron Neff, and Matt Porter.
Akhenaten's monotheism is definitely an interesting topic worth exploring. My caution is in using this one-off debated example in Egyptian religion to support the idea that monotheism was an accepted option in the day generally, and therefore, here's the punchline, and therefore there is no reason to think that the Israelites weren't monotheists from the very beginning of their existence. Now that's a mouthful, so let me flesh that out a bit. Akhenaten's monotheism has been jumped on by conservatives. For various reasons, there is a strong scholarly consensus that Israelite religion was not monotheistic early on, but monolatrous. Monolatry means that the Israelites believed in the existence of many gods, even though they worshipped only one, their God, Yahweh. You know, the Bible itself, not to get into all this, but the Bible itself has many passages that only work if we assume monolatry, one being Psalm 95. You know, just read the first few verses where Yahweh is referred to as the great king above all gods. He outranks them. And Exodus 12:12, where during the 10th plague, we read that God's judgment is coming, quote, on all the gods of Egypt. Now, at some point, which is hard to pin down, but probably after the exile, with some pre-exilic rumblings, to be sure, but sometime after the exile, at some point, the Israelites became more clearly monotheistic. And they certainly were monotheists long before we get to the time of Jesus. But you see, this is the point here. Akhenaten's unusual sort of religious move can't be used to push that monotheism back to the period of the Exodus, which is what conservatives hope Akhenaten can do for them. Now, if you're interested in more, you can search for monolatry on my website. And I think I've done, if I remember right, a Patreon video or two on this as well. I can't remember. Don't hold me to it, but check it out. Okay, next question.
For those of us already anxious about deconstructing, how can we be encouraged to continue our journey away from our roots in light of 2 Timothy 4:3?
But here's what this passage says, and I want to include verse 4 as well. For the time is coming when people will not put up with sound doctrine, but have itching ears. They will accumulate for themselves teachers to suit their own desires, and will turn away from listening to the truth and wander away to myths. Now, this passage seems like a warning not ever to change one's views and not to listen to anyone who tells you something different than what you believe. And worse, it's often used to shut down the journey of faith that many people find themselves on. People who listen to this podcast, for example, who aren't looking for ways to be radical or unfaithful or rebellious, but who have had experiences that have led them to question what they have been taught. Seeing the old faith differently is normally a very painful process, and clearly this questioner is going through a process like that and is, in my opinion, repeating a, you know, quote, warning from Scripture that he has heard from others, like friends or pastors, perhaps. One problem here is the use of this passage this way treats the Bible as an owner's manual for faith, where every passage is meant somehow to give us the answer here and now. And, you know, where we tend to see ourselves in the right and others in the wrong. And exposing the problems with this way of approaching the Bible is a big theme in two of my books, The Bible Tells Me So, and How the Bible Actually Works. And once this owner's manual view of the Bible is removed, we can begin to see the Bible as a source of wisdom, not a source of proof texts. The Bible, I feel, is it's much better understood as modeling the quest for wisdom in this life and not handing us tweet-length answers. And the Bible models this quest for wisdom by being chock-full of diverse real-life scenarios of people of faith who respond by faith to their particular situations in different ways. So the question I would have about 2 Timothy 4 is, well, what is the situation of the letter? Of course, that's not easy to discern, and I admit it's much easier, again, to take this as a one-size-fits-all command from God, but I don't think it's wise to take phrases from this passage and simply infuse them with meaning as we see fit. You know, what does it mean for this author to, you know, abandon sound doctrine and have itching ears? You know, anything we don't like can fill that void today, from watching a PG movie to worshiping Satan. And how these phrases are filled with meaning will probably be determined by those who are in power, those who get to make the call, the leaders of the church, the school, the denomination. Absolutely anyone can appeal to 2 Timothy 4, fill the words with meaning, and come out looking squeaky clean and others really evil. You know, Paul himself was a victim of such thinking. He was considered a false teacher, tickling itching ears, moving unsuspecting people away from sound doctrine and from truth to follow myths. Like when he said that circumcision and dietary restrictions are not required for Gentiles to be full-fledged members of the family of Abraham. See, a passage like this is just waiting to be weaponized, but the problem isn't the passage, but what is expected from it, a clear word from God to us in our moment, rather than a passage that requires tremendous wisdom and maturity to understand how or if this present situation calls for this passage. You know, to make the absurd point, I wouldn't say that changing from a traditional to a contemporary worship style is abandoning sound doctrine, even if I would strongly prefer one over the other. When you're having questions about biblical inerrancy or the historicity of parts of the Bible or contradictions in the Gospels, is that evidence of your simply surrounding yourself by false teachers to satisfy your own desires? And 2 Timothy 4 is God's way of condemning you? Or are you really struggling with something and have good reason for it? Like I said, too often we read passages like this and see ourselves immediately on the right side of the question, and others who think differently on the other side. Rarely do we turn this inward to see whether the power structures we support and simply assume to be right might actually be at odds with sound doctrine or might be tickling itching ears with false teaching. I want to suggest that the questioner is already in this process of critiquing the system from within. He's not a rebel, but observing from the inside where the pieces of the system are no longer fitting together for him. You know, a while back in one of our monthly book groups for our patrons over Patreon, we read John Caputo's little book, What Would Jesus Deconstruct? And one of the powerful points he makes is that the kind of deconstruction that our questioner is experiencing is not an attack on the faith from the outside. Rather, it rises up internally, caused by the inherent instability of any theological or ecclesiastical system, especially one that claims to be sitting on top of the mountain looking down at everyone else. Now, I wish we could all take that to heart and hold our theologies more gently, rather than weaponizing the Bible to give the appearance that God is on our side. Now, and briefly, another issue I have with using this passage as a proof text to keep people in line is that it denies the inevitable reality that faith does in fact change over time. You know, I truly believe that the intellectual scaffolding we all create in our minds to hold our faith, I think that's all fine and it's normal and it's needed. But it's not permanent. That's the hard part. To switch metaphors, true faith is often presented as a wall that must be kept high and stable. And if it begins to crumble, it's our job to patch it right away, lest our faith weaken. And passages like 2 Timothy 4 are enlisted to support that point. But I see faith as more of a process, a journey, where certain walls do indeed weaken over time and need to come down when they become obstacles to our growth. I know we all have walls, but we need to be willing, I think, to take them down. I think that's the life of faith. And I believe that life of faith can only continue toward maturity as we risk taking that journey and not conspiring to keep that journey from happening. One of the points I make in the sin of certainty is that the Bible models this very journey into mystery rather than building walls of protection. Okay, let's move to the next question.
So, to my understanding, it seems that you understand Scripture as historically rooted, mythologically told in order to convey theology. So if Scripture is nothing more than a mythical story with some historicity, how is Christianity distinct?
I think about this question a lot, enough to know that I'm not able to give a three-point unassailable answer to it. This question really gets at the heart of the modern dilemma for the Christian faith. Knowing what we know about other ancient religions, what makes Christianity distinct? Good question, central question. Now, here's my take on it. In a way, all religions are distinct. So the fact that Christianity shares characteristics with other ancient religions doesn't make it less distinct. It just means that the distinction of the Christian faith isn't found in necessarily how well it keeps its distance from those other religions. Still, I do think that there is something distinct about the Christian faith, distinct in the sense that I don't see it elsewhere, though I'm definitely willing to be corrected here. It has to do, at least as far as I can see, it has to do with the cross and namely two things. First, Jesus' crucifixion is presented in the New Testament as something God initiates on behalf of humanity. And this is an odd idea in a world where sacrifice is something humans have been doing since forever. To appease gods, humans initiate it. And as others have noted, it seems like God is turning the whole idea of sacrifice on its head and putting an end to it. We hear verses like, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, and yawn because it's so familiar. But that idea of God giving a son on behalf of the world is an idea that strikes me as a distinct twist. Now let me add that I'm among those who does not think that God offered his son as a sacrifice in order to have his own wrath satisfied. That's a common view, even with some biblical support, but I think it breaks down for a variety of reasons we can't get into here, but I'm hardly the only person to think this way. And by the way, I say this well aware of passages like Romans 3:21-26, and no emails, please. I think the issue at stake is too subtle than can be handled by quoting a passage or two. The cross, I believe, is God putting an end to the notion that humans sacrificing animals or other humans is a bridge to divinity. At any rate, I think the cross is distinct in that it is presented as a sacrifice from God on behalf of humans. And the second distinct thing about the cross, the God we meet in the New Testament is not one who keeps his distance from the humiliation of Roman crucifixion. See, this is the paradox of the New Testament, that God's power is seen through the humiliation of this particular Roman style of crucifixion, which is a very humiliating one. And that idea sometimes just stops me dead in my tracks. And I have to say, when I ask myself what is distinct about Christianity and why bother with it, this is where my mind goes. And, you know, it's been said that if you wanted to start a new religion in the Greco-Roman world, your story would not center on the crucifixion of its founder, nor would it tolerate the creator's willing participation in that humiliation. See, gods aren't shamed, but the Christian faith is grounded by this very counterintuitive and paradoxical claim. Now, to be clear, these distinctives don't amount to proof that Christianity is true. I'm just offering some observations of what makes it distinct, in my opinion. Believing these things are true is a matter of faith, and I don't say that cheaply. Many of us are used to thinking there are all sorts of reasons for Christianity being distinct, and there may very well be more that just don't strike me at the moment. But the question of what makes Christianity distinct will never go away, especially given our increasing understanding of the ancient world and of other religions. We could spend hours on this, but at least that's a start. Now, one more point I'd like to address about all this. The questioner is concerned about the Bible being, quote, nothing more than mythical story with some historicity. And I think she's using the word myth and story somewhat interchangeably, which is fine for the point I want to make, though they are not the same thing technically speaking. No need to go into all that. Though I do understand the concern about losing history in the Bible, and just let me say one or two things about that. Whether or not we are comfortable with it, history mixed with story is exactly what we see in the Bible. Actually, there is no telling of history anywhere that isn't at the same time woven together with unhistorical elements, call that story. There is no such thing as history writing that is kept pure, devoid of non-historical elements introduced by the writer, either intentionally or unintentionally. The past has to be told, and as soon as it is, we have introduced the influence of the storyteller. The interesting thing to see here, as far as I'm concerned, is not, you know, whether this happens in the Bible, but what are the implications of this happening in what we call scripture. Okay, one last question, and here it is.
As I lean away from an inerrant view of the Bible, I'm getting backlash from my evangelical friends. That's almost everyone. It scares the shit out of me, to be honest. Is there hope in keeping my loving community? I'm in a scared stage right now.
I really resonate with this question. I get it a lot, and I've lived it too. The thing is, it's very hard to keep engaged in an evangelical community if one's views are shifting from those of the community. Remember that evangelicalism is a separatist movement that's defined by its members holding to certain, you know, essentially non-negotiable ideas. No longer believing in biblical inerrancy is one of several conversation stoppers. And in my opinion, and in my experience, it's hard to maintain intimacy with a group when that group's core ideals are felt to be challenged. A social, personal distance is created because of theological differences. That's why the distance is created. And it's hard to maintain those associations despite those differences when those beliefs are central to evangelical identity. For the record, I think this is not simply an evangelical or fundamentalist problem, but I think that the tipping point is easier to get to the more conservative the church is. There are just more issues to collide over. Also, I don't think that this social distancing, if I can use that phrase, is necessarily intentional on the part of the group. Sometimes it is, but sometimes it's just, you know, the unconscious power of groupthink and the unspoken rules of the community that we aren't always conscious about. When your beliefs challenge the evangelical theology of your church or organization, I think you have two choices: to not talk about these things because you value the group, or leave the group to find another community. A bad move, which I'll tell you a secret, I've made this move, don't tell anybody, but a bad move is to try to change the church or change the organization, whatever, to change it to your way of thinking. That's very stressful and even unfair to expect others to get on board with a journey it might have taken you months or years to get to. And it never works. At best, it simply divides people along political lines. Even if you win, you lose. Now, there is an intermediate approach. Find discreetly those in your group who are on a similar journey and then meet informally to discuss all those things you feel you can't discuss openly. That may be a way of keeping the best of both worlds, but in my opinion, it will only delay the second option. You will grow used to the freedom and the relief of such a group and begin asking yourselves why you're living a double life. And gee, wouldn't it be nice to just be in a church where we don't have to meet on the side? How to handle this situation will be different for everyone, and I know individuals and couples who have made the decision to value the group over their expanding theological boundaries, and it works. This is often the case when children are involved, if they have like a strong network of friends, right, or a decent youth group. Though, and maybe you're already anticipating what I'm about to say, the polar opposite scenario is true too. For some, it's exactly what their children are hearing in church that scares the parents and motivates them to find another church home that doesn't base its teachings on ideas that the parents will have to balance or contradict at home. But, you know, regardless, you know, leaving the community is hard, and I've done that, and I've felt a lot of relief when I did. But over the years, I could see the unintended, unanticipated consequences of the loss of a community. You know, children growing up and our not being a part of their milestones, not having people in your life who have known you consistently for, you know, 10, 20, 30 years and who will be there to help in times of trouble. I take loss of community very seriously, but for me, the freedom to be curious, to explore, to follow my instincts, to listen to my experiences and to that inner voice, well, those things, they all trump the benefits of the community. You know, but I have had my mourning periods. I still do. It's just that the mourning for me would have been greater had I stayed in a place that would have crushed my soul and my mind. Which, by the way, isn't a judgment. The situation would have crushed me, and that's all I'm saying. For others, the same situation may be like a safe haven. And I guess that's the main point of this. Each situation is different, and knowing what to do is a very personal act, and it takes some courage to accept the responsibility, to be very deliberate, and then follow that decision where it leads. And, you know, part of the emotional struggle, which we never talk about, but that's so important. Part of the emotional struggle can be soothed a bit by trying to remember, to tell yourself, to remind yourself that you know, God may be out ahead of you and inviting you on this very even difficult journey. You know, rather than believing that your church is the only place where God can be found. It was sobering to me to try to explain my former church situation to non-evangelical Christian friends of mine. And, you know, they simply couldn't relate. This is such an internal kind of thing. And the issues that preoccupy evangelicalism are not even on the radar of those other Christians. And I guess, you know, in retrospect, even though that might have been a little bit unsettling for me at one point, it has encouraged me over the years to know that evangelicalism is not the norm, as simple as that, and that there are other vibrant communities of Christian faith out there. Okay, folks, before we go, two quick things. First, Jared's book, Love Matters More, is out. Listen, it's thoughtful, challenging, timely, and generally just amazing. Cancel all plans, grab a copy, and spread the word. Also, coming up, we are offering a new course, Everyday Life in Ancient Israel, and it will be taught by archaeologist and college professor Dr. Cynthia Schaefer Elliott. This course is awesome. I've seen the content. We could not be more excited. The course runs for 4 consecutive Tuesdays beginning October 6th. For more information, including registration, head on over to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/courses.
A quick reminder that we will have the smart and talented Cynthia Schaefer Elliott, PhD in biblical studies, but even cooler, current member of an excavation team in Israel, specialist in archaeology and everyday life in Bible times, teaching a course for us called Everyday Life in Ancient Israel. If you've ever wondered what it was like to live in ancient Israel, what was a household like? What kind of religion did actual people practice? And how does that affect how we read our Bible? Then this would be the course for you. Normally, we have our courses for around $99, but we understand that a lot of people are feeling uncertain about things right now, and we don't want anyone turned down for a lack of funds. So this course is pay what you can, pay what you want. No amount is too small, but of course, we appreciate your support so we can keep offering the best in biblical scholarship to everyday people. The course will be live every Tuesday night in October from 8:30 to 10 p.m. Eastern, but no need to be there live unless you want to be able to ask Cynthia questions there and have her respond in real time, which is a real treat. Otherwise, though, each night will be available for download a few days later. So to register, just head to pdens.com/everydaylife. Again, that's pdens.com/everydaylife. We hope to see you there.
See you, folks.
Thanks, as always, to our team. Executive producer Megan Kamick, audio engineer Dave Gerhart, creative director Tessa Stultz, marketing wizard Reed Lively, transcriber and community champion Stephanie Spate, and web developer Nick Striegel. For Pete, Jared, and all of us here at the Bible for Normal People, thanks for listening.
Now, one other angle that might help clear things up. When I say things like, oh gosh, it's not even noon and I'm falling asleep. All right. The problem is that that didn't make any sense. I'll try it again. The course runs for 4 consecutive Tuesdays beginning October 6th and runs for 4 consecutive weeks. That's redundant. The course runs for 4 consecutive Tuesdays beginning October 6th. Oh gosh, I can't speak. Okay, 2 more sentences, Pete. You can do this. You're a good man, Dave. Always make me sound good.